From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
One of Florida's most savvy public revenue hawks thinks the president's tariff-o-rama is bad, at least in the near term.
We're going to get initially impacted negatively by high tariffs on imports.
Also this week, the state of Florida seems destined to be a major lockup point for immigrants taken into custody for whatever reason.
We're talking about quote-unquote alligator Alcatraz, but we haven't even mentioned the fact that they're working on a second facility
at Camp Landing.
We'll also get the latest on the new Florida law limiting how citizens propose constitutional changes, as well as some good news on the state's affordable housing front. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. President Donald Trump has flirted with implementing sweeping international tariffs for months. His latest plan includes enacting at least a 10% tariff on all countries starting August 1st. Tristan Wood spoke with economics experts about how those potential tariffs could impact Florida and its residents.
Randall Holcomb, a professor of economics at Florida State University, worries Trump's plan will lead to rising costs for Floridians.
The tariffs, essentially, it's a tax on American consumers. And it's politically motivated by companies, domestic companies, who want protection from foreign competition. The same thing applies to foreign countries. They'll put tariffs on American goods because the foreign manufacturers don't want American competition in their domestic markets.
Florida Tax Watch, a Tallahassee-based taxpayer research institute, recently released a report that found tariffs could impact costs across products in Florida. They project the price of new cars could go up at least $6,000 to $7,000. Grocery bills could go up 10 to 15%. Dominic Calabro, the group's CEO, expects Trump's plan to have a significant short-term impact in the state.
The total import value that Florida has as the 10th largest importer of the 50 states in the United States of America is $117 billion, essentially the size of our state budget.
Holcomb agrees Florida will be heavily impacted, but he says other states could see even bigger effects. He points to regions that have large manufacturing industries that rely on imported raw materials.
I mean, if you were Michigan and you're importing a lot of auto parts for your factories, that's going to have a bigger impact. But in Florida, we don't really have that issue.
The Trump administration has frequently mentioned that other countries impose tariffs on American goods. But Holcomb says in those cases, the tariffs are typically targeted on specific industries and are historically there to boost manufacturing in those countries.
These days, the most important reasons go back to the days after World War II. Manufacturing was decimated in Europe, in Japan. Those economies were trying to rebuild. And as part of the rebuilding, they erected protective tariffs to protect domestic industries from American competition. And those tariffs have tended to remain in place.
Trump has said his goal is to use the tariffs to bring back more domestic manufacturing. And Calabro says he believes Trump's plan could work.
His electoral win were those in the middle class, hardworking industries that were going to get initially impacted negatively by high tariffs on imports. But I think he's going to work hard to turn that around so it's working towards their benefit and the benefit of all Americans.
Holcomb thinks tariffs are the wrong move.
I would favor everybody reducing their tariffs. But I also think, regardless of what foreign countries do, that we're better off in the United States if we reduce our tariffs, because those tariffs are a tax on American consumers. So the best thing we can do for American consumers is make goods and services as affordable as possible.
Whether the president will move forward with his current plan remains to be seen. I'm Tristan Wood.
A migrant detention center in the heart of the Everglades is now open. It's known, as I'm sure you've heard, as Alligator Alcatraz. President Donald Trump attended the opening last week, along with Governor Ron DeSantis and Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast from the News Service of Florida, host Derek Ham is joined by reporter Forrest Saunders of EW Scripps to discuss the controversial center. Here's an excerpt.
We're talking about the immigration detention center that is built in the Everglades. What are you calling? I'm resisting calling it Alligator Alcatraz, although it seems to be everyone is calling it.
They have now put up a sign outside the facility that says Alligator Alcatraz. The state is considering it the formal name of the spot. So, I mean, I know that it's a charged name for some people, like it's politically charged, and some people even called it disgusting. Critics have taken issue with about every aspect of it. But the way that I handle it is I refer to it first as a migrant detention and deportation facility. Mm-hmm. And then I say, also known or dubbed Alligator
dubbed,
Alcatraz.
Dubbed. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Thank you. Should I write that down? I can use it. Do I have to give you a nickel?
No, you don't have to pay me anything. But yeah.
No, that's what I've been doing.
It's a full sentence in order to just introduce it.
Yes. So it's creating quite a stir.
That's a word. And it's doing exactly what I think the governor's office hoped it would do.
So brilliant. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is an opportunity for them to lean in and do some of that red meat stuff that they have basically become famous for. I mean, his comms team leading up to his 2024 run, they were the best in the country. I mean, you could make that argument. And that was because they just leaned in on all these issues.
Oh, yeah.
They had catchy headlines and titles.
Yep.
They were able to make splashy, big Republican goals happen. And this is sort of like OG DeSantis, right?
It's on steroids, mm-hmm. though. And, you know, they went in there. They did this. They seized the property. Florida's leading on this. We were the first to do the, like, requiring everybody to enter into these 287G contracts. You know, I don't know if it's like we're a numbers thing, you know, where you can say, okay, well, we have collected X number of undocumented immigrants and deported X number.
They see this as the big political boon next to the economy, right? This was the mandate that voters gave them in 24, and they have to deliver. And we're talking about, quote unquote, Alligator Alcatraz, but we haven't even mentioned the fact that they're working on a second facility.
Yes,
at Camp Landing. Right, just outside of Jacksonville in northeast Florida. And this is going to be a facility that can house up to 2,000.
Right.
And then, you know, cumulative capacity for the state could be up to 5,000. So this is not just Florida's detention center. This sounds more and more like America's.
Well, you know, the part of the reason for that is ICE does not have enough detention center beds.
Right.
So they don't have enough detention beds. That's been a problem. And I've heard Sheriff Galtieri talk about this all the time. So this is a way of, I doubt that it's exponentially increasing the number of ICE beds, but we're going to be providing a lot more beds. And, you know, whether they're all going to be coming from Florida, I don't know. In Jacksonville, it would really make sense that they're going to be coming in. They're going to be bringing in people from Georgia. I don't know about Miami. You know, I don't know what the plan is.
We really haven't gotten those
details. But we also have a lot of undocumented immigrants in Florida.
I talked to a Democrat just the other day about this whole project, and they believed that there was a real chance, because you can, if you look online, and I know that, you know, social media is not a barometer for the pulse of the nation like we sometimes think it is or we attribute it to.
Right.
But you will see posts where some people are like, I'm all for getting rid of undocumented people,
mm-hmm.
but do we have to grandstand? Do we have to do the political theater?
Right.
And so this Democrat was saying, you watch, Democrats are definitely going to condemn this, but Republicans will keep leaning in because they think it's a big win.
Mm-hmm.
But they said they did not believe, much like first term Trump, they did not believe that Americans wanted to see how the sausage is made. Because the moment that those pictures of kids
being torn away from their mothers, the kids once that, crying.
Yeah, once that went out,
yeah.
It became a rallying cry for Democrats and opponents of the president's agenda back in the first term. And it was ultimately one of the things that defeated him in 2020. So you fast forward to this now, and there's this question of whether or not leaning in like this, creating facilities like this, while Republicans are eating it up largely and celebrating it, is it the win that they think it is, or is it going to isolate some of those more moderates who do not want to see how this happens?
And how will that play out in the midterms?
Right.
Hear more of that conversation on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Weeks after vetoing a study into the impact of artificial intelligence on Florida workers, Governor Ron DeSantis says the state will develop a plan to prevent AI from taking over. While offering few details, DeSantis warned this week of what he calls very dangerous impacts of rapidly changing AI. Last month, DeSantis vetoed a bill dealing with automation and artificial intelligence. The bill, which passed the legislature in April with only one dissenting vote, would have directed part of the State Department of Commerce to study issues such as job losses and gains. DeSantis says Florida will develop its own approach on the evolving issue.
We can't put our head in the sand and just say we're not going to deal with AI at all, because it is becoming a fact of life. But, you know, we can't just turn the reins over to a bunch of tech overlords. That doesn't work.
Last month, DeSantis criticized a congressional proposal that would have prevented states from regulating artificial intelligence. The U.S. Senate ultimately rejected the proposal. Coming up on Capitol Report, for the time being at least, there will be no changes to how Florida citizens can propose changes to the state's constitution.
These rulings aren't handed out lightly. For a court to grant one, they have to believe we're likely to win the case, and that real harm is happening right now.
There's good news in Florida's new budget for advocates of more affordable housing.
To have an infrastructure in place that we can invest more in to further fill gaps.
With federal clean energy incentives soon to be history, the question is, can renewable energy enterprise survive in the Sunshine State?
And these incentives over time have created a robust clean energy economy that may be durable enough to withstand these changes.
Florida boaters and motorists are being urged to slow it down if they have to travel on flooded streets. The impact on nearby properties can be huge.
And we're talking thousands and thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands per house.
And it seems life just gets tougher and tougher for what used to be a vibrant variety of fish in the seas around Florida.
We're now introducing a new component of natural mortality that's going to kill somewhere between X and Y number of sawfish.
A federal district judge has temporarily blocked part of a Florida law that made new rules for how citizens can change the state constitution. As Margie Menzel reports, the groups working to get proposed amendments on the ballot say that means their work can move forward, at least for now.
The ruling by Judge Mark Walker pauses part of a law banning people who aren't U.S. or Florida residents from gathering petitions. The rest of the new law went into effect on July 1st. Florida Decides Healthcare, which is trying to expand Medicaid, is one of the groups involved in the challenge. Mitch Emerson, the group's executive director, says the state constitution protects the rights of Floridians to amend the document.
Since 1968, people in the state have had the ability to bring issues they care about straight to the ballot. Now politicians are trying to take that right away. This isn't just some policy tweak. It's a deliberate attempt to silence everyday people.
Other plaintiffs include Smart and Safe Florida, which backs recreational marijuana for adults, and Florida Right to Clean Water. In his ruling, Walker determined that the plaintiffs are likely to succeed on their challenges against the parts of the law he put on hold. Emerson says it's good news for the groups racing to gather signatures for a ballot initiative.
Because the decision gives us the clarity we need. While we don't agree with every single piece of the ruling,
It removed major obstacles and affirmed that our campaign and our people can keep doing the work without being silenced or punished.
The state has maintained that the law is needed after they say the 2024 election season saw instances of fraud by petition gatherers. Walker rejected that argument, but let parts of the new law stand. Those include a 90-day moratorium on supervisors of election processing the petitions and a rule that requires people who collect more than 25 petitions to register with the state. I'm Margie Menzel.
Affordable housing programs in Florida are not solely dependent on federal dollars. As WUSF's Lily Belcher reports, Governor Ron DeSantis has approved state money for local programs that could meet some of Florida's need for low-income housing.
Florida's budget includes $235 million for a pair of programs that subsidize affordable housing development. The State Housing Initiative Partnership, or SHIP, and the State Apartment Incentive Loan, or SALE, are funded by the Sadowski Trust Fund. Without federal support, Florida Housing Coalition CEO Ashawn Nesbitt says state support is necessary to meet affordable housing needs.
We're very fortunate in Florida to have those programs in place, to have an infrastructure in place that we can invest more in to further fill gaps.
In Florida's recently signed budget, DeSantis once again fully funded the SHIP and SALE programs. Mark Hendrickson is the director of the coalition, which lobbies for the allocation of the Sadowski Trust Funds for Affordable Housing Programs.
You need to have a certainty that the funding is going to be there because, you know, you don't just build apartments in a day.
He says with the state's support, private developers should have an easier time building low-income housing.
They're well-built, well-maintained, and the people that are living there are just people in low-wage jobs.
Hendrickson said these developments are nicer than publicly funded Section 8 housing, but ultimately serve the same function. I'm Lily Belcher in Tampa.
Now that Congress has approved President Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill, clean energy advocates in Florida are bracing for the fallout. The measure removes tax incentives that pay for nearly one-third of the cost of installing solar panels. The changes could threaten the viability of 9 clean energy factories and over 10,000 jobs in Florida. WUSF Steve Newborn talks about the implications with Maggie Schober and Stan Cross of the advocacy group Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
This so-called big, beautiful bill is going to be big and bad for the solar industry. It's changing the calculus for electric utilities that have already planned solar, which most in Florida have solar projects in the works that now will cost more.
When you say the cost of solar panels, for instance, will go up, can you give me maybe a rough estimate of how much for the average house?
The tax credits for homes that wanted to put solar on their roofs were for about 30% of the cost. So now households will pay 100% of those costs instead of that about 70% or so.
So if you want to put solar panels on your roof, for instance, or put up a wind turbine, do it now, right?
Yes, absolutely. Get on it quickly. I think the lines are already pretty long.
There was a report by the Solar Energy Industries Association. They said that 9 clean energy factories in Florida are at risk of closing or never opening if this bill passes. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yes, that is what we're seeing. There are also tax credits to encourage clean energy to manufacture here in the U.S. And so those are going away as well.
How would this bill affect sales of electric vehicles?
The bill will also impact electric vehicles by eliminating credits for purchasing new and used EVs. That's big in Florida because Florida is now number one in the Southeast for EV sales and the second biggest state in the country for EV sales. So that market is thriving, and it's a shame to try to take out some of that momentum. At the same time, the electric horse might have already left the barn in Florida. There are so many EVs on the road and drivers are so satisfied with those electric vehicles. There's also a hope that that market momentum will persist even despite the efforts of this bill to slow it down.
Do you believe that the Inflation Reduction Act accomplished its mission of jumpstarting the businesses, especially here in Florida? And maybe we don't need the tax credits so much anymore.
The Inflation Reduction Act set market conditions in a favorable way for the clean energy sector. And that clean energy sector was just getting going. And what this bill does is inject a whole lot of uncertainty into the market. And if there's one thing business does not like, it's uncertainty. So the impact of this bill, it's unknown at this point, but it could be catastrophic. By removing those incentives just as the private sector was making good on their investments and job growth.
Do you believe that the state's clean energy industry can survive the rollback of these tax credits?
The clean energy incentives that this bill seeks to roll back were put in place to create a level playing field in the energy economy. The fossil fuel industry is arguably one of the most subsidized industries in our entire economy. And these incentives over time have created a robust clean energy economy that may be durable enough to withstand these changes. But that's the wrong question. This is an economy that is creating jobs, that is creating a global competitive advantage for our country in an energy sector that is growing worldwide. And for America to lose our global energy leadership is foolish. This is the biggest gift we could ever have given to China and other countries that are already outcompeting us in many global markets.
Maggie Schober and Stan Crosser with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Our pleasure.
A new Florida law is designed to expand privately operated charter schools called Schools of Hope. Part of the law allows charters to co-locate inside traditional public schools, as WMNF Sarah Goebel reports.
The bill passed on the last day of the legislative session, June 17th, while many people were focused on the state budget. Damaris Allen, Executive Director of Families for Strong Public Schools, says it could harm traditional public education.
It basically allows another school system to operate rent-free in our public schools, but someone has to pay the cost that goes around along with operating those schools, and that's going to be our traditional public school. And why that is a challenge is that the way our funding system in Florida works is that we fund schools by students in seats. And so that means if that co-located charter school has a certain number of students, they're getting the same amount per student as the traditional public school, except they're not having to pay for the physical building like our traditional public school.
Democratic State Representative Fentress Driscoll is also concerned how it might impact funding for public schools.
I think it really sounded the alarms because we have a constitutional obligation to fully fund or adequately fund our public schools and to make sure that we are providing high quality public schools. And it feels very difficult to do that when any charter school, which yes, technically is a public school, but when any charter school can just come in and take over. And so it feels very, very threatening to our neighborhood public schools.
Supporters say the law could expand school choice options. It could also allow charter schools to have stricter codes of conduct. I'm Sarah Goebel.
Among the many, many new laws that took effect in Florida this month, one of them allows cities to set up slow speed limits for flooded streets, as WMNF's Madison Overmeyer tells us.
When someone is driving too fast and recklessly on a flooded street, it can often create dangerous wakes. The moving water can enter and damage homes. Kevin Batdor, president of the Shore Acres Civic Association in St. Petersburg, says the idea for the law originated in Shore Acres.
You're causing more damage, not only to your own vehicle driving through salt water, but to people's homes. And we're talking thousands and thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands per house. It's crazy.
If drivers are not following the speed limits in the flood zones, officers now have the power to hand out citations. Mike Kovacek, assistant chief at St. Pete Police Department, says they have used public service announcement for years to encourage people to slow down and not drive through flooded waters.
The catalyst behind the law was to kind of put a little bit of teeth to the fact that we're trying to get people to do the right thing. After the storm has subsided, there's still water in the roadways. You're hoping as a homeowner, maybe the water did not go into your house, or if it did, it had receded. And the last thing they want is a large pickup truck or a vehicle to drive down the street and push all that water back into their residence.
He says police hope that the residents will listen to their public service announcements and they will not have to resort to handing out citations. I'm Madison Overmeyer.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, 2 years after an ocean heat wave slammed South Florida, scientists think they have a better idea of what killed endangered sawfish months later. WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich has this update.
When endangered sawfish began dying by the dozens amid a strange fish kill that also left dozens of other species in the lower Keys spinning and showing signs of distress.
It was another deadly week in the Keys as more and more carcasses of sawfish were pulled from nearshore water.
Scientists raced to save the sawfish and figure out what was killing them. That audio was from WPLG. Ross Busek is a marine biologist with the Bonefish Tarpon Trust. He says scientists quickly identified a toxic bottom-dwelling algae as the main culprit. But when they launched a follow-up investigation, Busek says they had to answer a more perplexing question.
Is this going to be the new normal? And what is the long-term consequences for that? You know, if it comes back at the same intensity that it did in the past, I mean, we can't lose 54 sawfish every year.
The heat wave likely allowed the toxic algae to spread because the heat killed things that either ate the algae or took up space that allowed the algae to expand.
If there's no cops to keep the bad guys in line, things can proliferate.
After the heat wave, sick fish began appearing once waters cooled. So last fall, as temperatures again cooled, Busek said scientists and anglers set up a monitoring network to be on the lookout.
It was around mid-November. I saw the first couple spinning mullet, and then 2 days later, I got a call about someone seeing some. And we're like, oh no, it's coming back. Here we go.
By February this year, he says there were at least 10 dead sawfish, but then the dying stopped. That raised a number of questions. Was it a legacy effect, and the sawfish were just now starting to die? Or were so few sawfish left that hardly any were left to die? Or was the algae less toxic? Scientists didn't find it at levels as high as before. They also wondered if maybe another algae could be involved. Even with those unknowables, Busek said the big takeaway is clear.
We're going to probably have this tax on the sawfish population like indefinitely. Like we're now introducing a new component of natural mortality that's going to kill somewhere between X and Y number of sawfish. And the question is, how do we recoup that tax?
Better fishing regulations could help. Sawfish often get tangled in shrimp trawling nets that drag the ocean floor. Shallow bays and estuaries where sawfish give birth are also in worse shape. In the Everglades, water is often too salty. And in southwest Florida, near Naples and the 10,000 Islands, there's pollution from storm runoff and septic tanks. And, he says, scientists need to figure out a way to predict the events.
How bad is it going to be for the years coming up? What parts of the environment change to allow this algae to proliferate? And is there anything we can do to really stop that from occurring?
That way, they're ready to respond when there's a next time. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Dara Cam, Lily Belcher, Steve Newborn, Sarah Goebel, Madison Overmeyer, and Jenny Stiletovich. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.